This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org.
Hey, Dr. Lyle, how are you doing today?
Good. About yourself?
Not too bad. Today's topic we're going to be talking about is how to feel good and how to succeed at life improvement. Now, you know, the new year's come and passed. It's been about a month, and I don't know what the data is on this, but most people have resolutions, and then what is it, 12 days after, most people are just about done with it?
A few hours, actually.
It's a few hours. I thought I was the only one. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, maybe about a week and a half ago, me and my buddies, we're always just trying to, you know, succeed at this life improvement stuff and failing miserably, at least I am.
Right.
And So what we decided to do is, you know, we picked a couple of things that we're trying to do, and we thought, you know what, let's make a bet and kind of use the competitive processes between males to see if we can achieve this. And we set some pretty clear goals, tried to keep ourselves out of the ego trap, lowered our expectations a little bit. Set the goals, and our punishment, basically losing the bet, is we tried to figure out what we both hate, like really despise. And it turns out for him, if he messes up on some of his goals, he's got to sing a karaoke song of my choice. You know, if any listener wants to send me an email as to what, you know, fun karaoke songs I can recommend for him, it could be a girl or a guy. That should be fun. But my punishment is for every time I mess up, I have to do something I despise, which is I have to march in a feminist rally. So, and I have to actually pretend that I like it.
Got it. That's beautiful.
Yeah. So,
that's
so
pretty
far,
good.
Yeah. So far, you know, we've been going at it pretty strong. It's only been a week and a half. Yeah. So, you know, hopefully I don't end up having to march in like 17 feminist rallies. God knows there's going to be a lot of them in the next 4 years. But this got me thinking, when people try to succeed at life improvement, for us, it's only been a week and a half. So it seems to be this negative reinforcement, you know, the punishment seems to be working for us, but who the hell knows?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, well, what's also working there is there's status processes there.
Mm-hmm.
So between the two of you, so that's probably the most important the process that's going on. So, but anyway, all this is fine. You're weaseling around trying to figure out how to do something, and the something that you're trying to do is you're trying to influence the cost benefit analysis that underlies all behavior. That's actually what's taking place. So whenever you're trying to figure out, like how does motivation work, and should I go to a Tony Robbins seminar and discover my giant within by walking across, you know, phony hot coals, you know, whatever it is that people are magically trying to do, they're gonna buy a book on, I don't know, the magic of thinking big or whatever it is. Bottom line is that what they're trying to do. All motivation comes from the same place, and that motivation comes from a cost-benefit analysis. And so you're running cost-benefit analysis on all possible behavioral options, everything that you can imagine. You can't run cost-benefit analysis on things you can't imagine. So that's the value of getting new information, is because new information will alter the matrix of how it is that your head works, and new information will cause you to alter your cost-benefit analysis. Whether it causes you to alter your behavior is unknown, because it may not actually cause the ultimate decisions that arise out of the cost-benefit analysis to change. So, for example, if we have someone contemplating a dietary change, and we tell some lady that's 50 pounds overweight that if she quits eating Snickers bars, she's going to lose 5 pounds in the next year. She just may decide, well, what's the difference? You know, it's not really, that isn't sufficiently attractive to be willing to put up with that sacrifice. If we told her that if she would stop the Snickers bars, she would lose 50 pounds in the next year, she probably wouldn't believe us, and so therefore she wouldn't do it either. So cost-benefit analysis is changed when you believe the new information, and it alters your analysis of the whole value propositions that you are observing and that you're contemplating and imagining. And therefore, it's new information winds up altering the landscape for you, and then that's how behavior changes. So that's the source of life improvement. And does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. So let's say, like, you tell somebody, hey, you're going to lose 50 pounds if you this, that, and the other, and they still don't believe you, even though it's factually correct. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you have to undersell, or, you know, you have to undersell something?
No, there's all kinds of all kinds of problems there. So there's all kinds of details, and this is it's very interesting when you're working with people one on one, and you are actually giving them you're the source of the new information. It's very interesting to observe that as you give them the new information, it may or may not tilt their cost-benefit analysis, and there may be reasons why it doesn't. So a primary reason is that, so for example, if I tell somebody that came in, they're 50 pounds overweight, and they eat and do everything wrong. So I start explaining to them that if they do things differently, then this is the way, this is animal nature, this is how this works. If you feed animals rich food, they wind up getting overweight. If you feed animals food consistent with their natural history, they lose the weight. No animal needs to override its hunger drive in order to be very fit. It's the natural state of organisms to be in ideal fitness, which maximizes their aesthetic impact on the opposite sex. So therefore, you will not have to eat less than you want or exercise more than you want, et cetera, et cetera. So I explain this, and as I then describe what whole natural foods is relative to what it is that they're eating, their imagination actively starts running the cost-benefit analysis. And they start realizing that they're not so motivated to do what it is that I'm saying. So now you watch the ambivalence in the system as you get two different scenarios running in parallel in the mind, in the imagination, as they flip back and forth between what it would be like to be 50 pounds lighter and what the impact of that would be versus what it is that they're going to have to get up to get there. And you watch, you can sort of observe this dissonance in people with respect to all kinds of things. A great deal of human unhappiness, in fact, most of it in this country, has to do with things that can be fixed. So most things are solvable. There's a reason why people experience the unhappiness that they do, and that is that unhappiness is a natural byproduct of a feedback that comes primarily from the social world, where we've had expectations violated in the negative. So you thought Susie was going to go with you to the prom, and it turns out that even though she's been your girlfriend for 2 months, she accepted a prom date from Bill, who's the quarterback of the football team. Okay, you're all bent out of shape about it, obviously, and with good reason. So your expectations have been violated in the negative. Okay, when you can be irritated that you expected to wait for 5 minutes in line at the bank when you got there, and it turns out there's 18 people in line, and you're going to be there for 40 minutes. Your expectations are violated in the negative, and you're irritated. Okay, so whenever your expectations are violated in the negative, You feel bad in some fashion. You might feel jealous, envious, depressed, anxious, or angry. Okay, a lot of different things you might feel depending upon the context of the situation. If your expectations are violated in the positive, you're excited, happy, loving, lustful, etc. In other words, those are positive feelings. You're flattered, etc. So you have positive feelings that told you, ooh, things were better than we thought. Negative feelings are, ooh, it's worse than we thought. And a relatively pleasant neutrality, not just neutral, but a pleasant neutrality of life when things have neither violated nor your expectations either direction. So what I'm interested in is recurrent moods that are negative in people. So someone that's depressed, someone that's anxious, someone that's bitter, someone that's angry, someone that's jealous, someone that's envious, et cetera, et cetera. So if there's someone who is persistently having an emotional tone to their life that is negative, that is very interesting to me. And it's interesting to me because it would not be consistent with the natural history of the organism for that to be a chronic state. Okay. So that the state that they're in that state because something about their relationship between themselves and their social environment is violating their expectations in the negative.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's what's happening. So people that are like angry all the time, generally it's because they're disagreeable people. And they have an unusual genetic variant there, and as a result, they're very entitled about a number of things, and they're going to spend a great deal of their life irritable, irritated, and with conflicted interpersonal relationships, etc. Someone who is not that way but is irritated and angry right now and bitter about something and has been even for a few years, that could be a situational dynamic between them and somebody else where they believe they've been treated very unfairly. Okay? So that's a different situation. So anyway, my point is that and what I'd like to share with anybody that's listening is that if you're unhappy about anything, that unhappiness is not an inevitable byproduct of being a human. Now, Freud thought so. Freud actually believed that life was just kind of miserable, and that was just sort of the nature of human life, and that's just how it was. that's not true. That's very clearly not the case. So that says more about his thinking and his own personal existence than it does about anything intelligent about psychological theory. you are designed by nature to strive for circumstances that yield improvements, and when those improvements happen, you're designed to get a noticeable shift in your mood towards positive. And when you fall short or you're negative or you get negative feedback, then you're going to have a negative feedback, etc. But the system is absolutely built well in order to encourage the following, and this is the fundamental basis of what's actually happening. And this is very deep biology, and then we'll peer down deep into the biology, and then we'll quickly come back up and talk about humans and how it is that we address problems of any type. fundamentally, what's going on is that an animal is just a little device for reproducing DNA, and that animal, what makes it an animal instead of a plant, is that this thing moves around and has muscles and it has a nervous system. And so so really what this thing has is it has a couple sources of energy that it's going to utilize in order to orchestrate behavioral patterns that are going to optimize its genetic success. So those two sources of energy are going to be calories that they're going to eat. And the other source of energy is going to be neural energy, or it's going to be the capability of its brain to run computations. It's going to have that energy replenished by sleeping. So and obviously as to build neurotransmitters from food. So this is how what this thing is. So if you don't think of it as a human, think of it as a generic organism. That what it's going to be is it's simply an animal that has the capacity for movement, so it can shift its location in space, and it does so by contracting muscles and relaxing other muscles in a pattern that alters its location. So when you are talking to some pretty girl, Nate, you are actually altering your location. You are, as your mouth moves, your mouth is moving because muscles are contracting and muscles are relaxing in a specific pattern for you to actually have words come out of your mouth that are discernible by the person that you're talking to. Okay, that's what's actually that's what's happening.
In order and when they run away really quickly after I start talking to them?
That's bad feedback, just so you know, in case you need help with a scorecard, okay? So you're also contracting certain muscles in order for you to remain standing, okay? And if you're like most men, when an attractive woman is around, you suck in your chest, you suck in your stomach. That isn't because you might be fat, because if our listeners would know this, but Nate's not fat at all, he's in superb shape. But what you also do when you suck in your stomach is you actually make the distinction between your chest, shoulders and chest, and your stomach a greater distinction. And that distinction, that V or that V pattern or a triangular upside down triangle pattern is attractive to females. So you enhance that by sucking in your stomach. So that's in case you wanted to know why you're sucking in your stomach, or actually you already knew why you're sucking in your stomach, but now I know why you're sucking in your stomach. And now you know that I know.
No, okay. I've read somewhere about this golden ratio where, like, if your shoulders are perfect ratio to your hips for men, then women find that exceedingly attractive.
Right.
Is there something in that, or is that just a...
No, there's no question about this. So it's going to turn out that just as males have ratios that signal to them that a female is very attractive, there's reasons why this could be. We're not actually altogether sure what all the reasons are. there's probably more than one reason. But it is so it's very clear that males have preferences for certain shapes of the female form, and females have preferences for the shape of the male form, and they're actually very stereotyped, and you can see what they are. So the hourglass shape of the female and the sort of equilateral kind of triangle upside down for the male with broad shoulders and narrow waistline, this is absolutely consistent with if you were to take data, which people have, on the statistical likelihood of a male having sex with partners outside of his primary relationship, that likelihood is much higher the better that ratio is. In other words, what it's doing is they are approached and they are signaled by females that they find attractive for what we call extra pair copulations. In other words, i.e., no investment, just give me some DNA. And that's what happens in the real world with respect to gene reproduction. So for guys who
are trying to do this, they don't necessarily need to look like Arnold Schwarzenegger. If they're pretty skinny, they probably want to work their shoulders pretty well. And then if they're overweight, all they need to do is lose the weight in the waistline, and now they can alter that.
Here I am trying to like explain very deep theory. And where do we go? we are instantly sidetracked into the details, which, you know, it's very interesting when people try to stick their heads in the sand about human nature. Human nature is actually not hard to determine. All you have to do is be willing to open your eyes without sticking your head in the sand. So, for example, So people make many comments about the culture and issues of man-woman differences and so on and so forth. It's very clear. The males are in the gym pushing the weights in order to get bigger, okay? Very obvious. They are also trying to get their hands on money, okay? So they want two things. They want muscles and money, which will make them more attractive. They are not stupid. They are reading the cues of females. They also intuitively know how the female brain works to some degree. And so there's a reason why we sell BMWs and gym memberships. That's a very clear thing. Females are at Macy's in front of one of the greatest frauds in the world, which is makeup. And so they're there with a bunch of attractive females as models for how good they could look if they put this stuff on them. And they're caught in an evolutionary arms race because the other females are doing the same thing. And so females have no doubt been painting their faces and trying to change the contours of their faces and trying to enhance their fertility cues for God knows how long. We know it goes back certainly through written human culture. And if it goes back that 6,000 years, we know it goes back another 60,000. So females are extremely concerned about their sexiness and their appearance. So are males. Males are additionally concerned with their resources, which are clearly a derivative and of their ability to hunt and protect and defend. And so this is just evolution playing out itself in the 21st century very clearly. That all makes sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So back to the deep, important stuff.
Yeah. Thank God. Okay.
Yeah.
So what's going to happen here is that when we're trying to change – oh, so what an organism is it's simply trying to move around the landscape, contracting muscles in a pattern that will optimize DNA reproduction. Now, when we get all the way to a human, well, we don't have to get there first. First of all, we can have to do is we can say that clearly what's going to happen is that it contracts these muscles in these patterns. This is not random. What these things have is they've got pre-programmed knowledge of how valuable certain targets are, mates, food, habitats, etc. And so they move in ways that enhance their relationship to the environment with respect to the opportunities and the threats in their habitat. So a rabbit doesn't have to learn that a fox is dangerous. It already inherently knows. It doesn't need to know. It doesn't need to learn that a hole is a good place to hide. It already knows. It doesn't need to learn that carrots are a good thing to eat. It already knows. Organisms come with a library that sits inside their DNA and gets reproduced, effectively created in flesh and blood inside their brain in order to do these computations and help the organism on its way. When they are successful and they get successful feedback, it feels good to them. And when they get distressing or they get negative feedback or they reduce their likelihood of survival reproduction, they feel bad. So organisms have good feelings and bad feelings for a reason, and good feelings and bad feelings are tracking, they're a reflection of genetic benefits and costs in the natural history of that species. So when a pretty girl smiles at you, Nate, that feels good. You don't have to learn that that's a good thing. You didn't even ever have to get laid. You knew that that was a good thing before you ever got laid. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
You knew that that smile is a statistical, this is a signal of increased statistical likelihood of getting laid, right? And so therefore you're already designed by nature to figure out what did I do that made that girl smile, okay? So if you talked positively about some political candidate and she's smiling, then you're going to continue to talk positively about that political candidate. You're not stupid, okay? You're simply tracking what it is that you seem to be doing that seems to be associated with the positive feedback, and you're trying to morph your behavior in order to have that good feedback continue. That basic strategy is the same strategy when you're trying to sell shoes. It's the same strategy when you're trying to keep your job or get a promotion. It's the same strategy when you're trying to have the Fosters over to your house so that you can be friends because you think that they're cool people. And it's the same thing when you're trying to find a mate. What you're trying to do is you're trying to do things, contract muscles in a way that will effectively result in positive feedback. And if you're a human, the social world is critical. If you're a leopard, the social world is not as important. You're contracting muscles in a way that reduces the likelihood of your kittens getting killed and reduces the increased likelihood of you making a kill on some food. So this is dependent upon what kind of organism it is. It's contracting muscles in ways that are efficient and effective for its biological success. Now, let's look at human life and human life improvement. People do things as best they can. They try to figure things out. They look for patterns. They have the genes helping them. They know who the good-looking people are. They know how good-looking they are. They know where it is that they should be targeting their efforts, and they know when they're wasting their time. So, and the average guy doesn't try to hit on the prom queen. The prom queen doesn't even give a glance or a smile at an average guy unless she's trying to get something out of him by dangling her sexuality in front of him so that he'll sign some paper or look the other way or give her a better grade on a test. In other words, she has no intention of having a relationship with this guy. So human beings are maneuvering as best they can. Our question is, why would anybody be persistently depressed or persistently thwarted or stymied in a given domain? The answer is that there's a limited number of reasons why this can be true. The first reason can be they can be miscalibrated, which means that they can actually think that they're better than they are. That's one possibility. That is certainly what it looks like. In other words, when someone is their business isn't going as well, or socially they're not doing as well, or romantically they're not as doing as well as they think they ought to be doing, it would appear that their misery is the result of the fact that their feedback seems to be pretty consistently worse than they expect. Okay? So that would cause there to be negative feelings. Now, it's also possible that usually people don't keep getting negative feedback worse than they expect because pretty soon they learn to expect it. So if they make a bunch of efforts and nothing changes, what happens is that their calibration lowers and then they are not as miserable. Nervous system has no interest in making you miserable. It's making you miserable for a reason. If you feel insecure, you've got insecurities about things, you're supposed to have insecurities about things. You are supposed to feel competitive vulnerabilities, and you're supposed to be looking over your shoulder and being concerned about how to address those in order to be more competitively successful. If, however, you have made efforts behind those insecurities and those anxieties that come up, you've hustled around, you've done what it is that you can, you've copied your competitors, and your feedback is still substantially lower than you would have expected, then what happens is that first you're depressed, and then you make peace with it. And I give the example, people will hear this and they'll first say, oh no, that's terrible. Oh, does that mean you give up? Does that mean you just settle on life? Absolutely not. It absolutely does not mean that. It means that the system is designed by nature to actually try to get you to utilize your muscular contractions and your neurons firing in such a way that is optimal to optimize your particular situation. It's not here to just have you settle at a mediocre life. That's not what it's here to do at all. It's going to use excitement and joy and love and lust and misery and disappointment and heartbreak. It's going to use it all. It's going to use every single tool in the toolbox to try to get you to live your life optimally. And if it turns out that you've set your sights too high, if you hustle around every way that you can think and then you fail, what's going to happen is you're not going to give up on life and then feel like you're mediocre and you have to live mediocre. Simply what's going to happen is you're going to set your sights lower. It changes everything. You don't do this consciously. It's done unconsciously. So this is the example that I give is 85% of eighth grade boys believe they're going to be professional athletes. Only 1 in 10,000 people will ever be a professional athlete. Most of those professional athletes do not become wealthy, okay? So it's going to turn out that very few people find fame or fortune in athletics, almost nobody. And yet almost none of us are miserable about this. So I'll just ask you, Nate, did you ever have any legitimate quasi-fantasies that you might be a professional athlete?
When I was playing hockey in high school and college, I used to joke around with my teammates and say, yeah, one day I'll be a 40-year-old, you know, rookie for the Pittsburgh Penguins.
Aha. Uh-huh. So, in other words, so you must have played hockey. Did you play hockey at the collegiate level?
No, not that good. That's why I was joking, because I thought it would take me 30 years to get to the level of a rookie.
Right, but you, where did you grow up, in the north somewhere where they had ice?
No, I grew up in Southern California, so I started roller hockey. Yeah, exactly.
Genetically
and
inferior.
I wasn't born in January and February like Malcolm Gladwell claims. So.
Right, that's what it, that must. You know, if you consult the right astrologer, you would have known this. Okay. So, all right. But the point is that so it turns out you're just kind of a loser in this whole way. So you didn't have any dreams that had to die.
In all seriousness, I do remember thinking, like,
yes.
Man, if I work pretty hard, I will try. Yeah. I can get to that level. And then it was just shattered pretty quickly because I wasn't even the top 10% of players. So
yes,
yeah.
Usually this realization sinks in to most of people by the 11th grade after they haven't made the JV team. And then it's actually off everybody's mind, 99% of them, by their first year of college. Of the ones that are actually collegiate athletes, this persists for a little while until they find out that they're not a starter in their third year, if they are even a scholarship athlete. And if it turns out that they're a starter and a star on their team, it becomes clear in the course of the season that they're rarely the best player on the floor, at which point they all start, you know, slowly watching their calibration in no miserable fashion, but they become calibrated and they realize that it might be a good idea to get that degree in communications so that maybe they can get a job. All right. Now, so the point is miscalibration is a very it's a ubiquitous characteristic of humans. They're going to tend to very often shoot too high, and they're going to expend some energy there. It would be a disaster if you had a chip that wasn't willing to shoot too high, because you might underestimate yourself, which would be an evolutionary crime. So you would absolutely would be worth putting out some effort to find out if you can have quick and easy relative success in a given area, i.e. that you have, quote, talent. And we would want to make sure that you have big dreams about the possibility of demonstrating your superiority over your competitors by making you think that the world is going to bow to you. So people put out some effort. Kids shoot baskets in the driveway. They put on roller skates and try to become Wayne Gretzky in Southern California. And they all try to become Joe Montana, or these days it's Tom Brady, or whatever else is it that they're trying to do. Trying to become Michael Jordan. Now, and those miscalibrations are quietly reorganized into accurate calibrations, and the person then spends their life pursuing opportunities that make the most sense at the time. Okay? So new information calibrates the system. Now, what about misery that's persistent? Okay, misery that's persistent is actually a very interesting signal. And that interesting signal indicates that the evidence is unclear about what the person's situation really is. So this person might be in a relationship where they're pretty unhappy, but the problem is, you know, they have moments where they're pretty happy, and then it turns out they're not happy, and then it turns out that they're kind of happy, and then maybe it's going to be fine, and then it turns out it's not happy, etc. So what they're getting is they're getting conflicting evidence. And the conflicting evidence is very frustrating for the system. The nervous system is trying to figure out what is the right course of action. and it looks for the patterns and it tries to figure out how to be successful, and it changes and modifies things in order to try to see whether or not they can find a sweet spot where the feedback is finally consistent with the expectations. So a great example for this would be hitters in the major leagues or golfers, okay? You won't see football players and basketball players doing too much tweaking of their skills, because their skills are more gross motor coordination. But hitting and pitching, as well as golf, these are very fine motor coordination skills. And the difference between success and being an also-ran is very, very narrow. It's a few neurons here and a few neurons there. And so as a result, people tweak and tweak and tweak and tweak and tweak, and they patiently or impatiently modify their strategies a little bit. And they either move towards more success or they don't. And if their expectations are consistently violated in the negative, they wind up increasingly frustrated and unhappy. They will eventually so one of the big problems in life is when you get sort of confusing feedback. A great example would be a relationship where one partner is not into the other partner, but the other partner really likes the first partner, and so they're hopeful, and they continue to be hopeful that maybe this relationship could work out. You know, they've been together 7 years, they've got a lot invested, they're best friends, et cetera, et cetera, and this thing is frustrating as hell. That the partner that isn't as much into this other partner, you know, hopes to maybe make it work and sort of signals that the other partner needs to make some changes, but they try to be nice about it because they're not sure whether or not it will really make any difference anyway. And if you signal that those changes need to be made, then you're essentially got an implied contract that that if the person makes those changes, then they will be acceptable. So this is a nasty little situation that many people are in, and it's a tough one, because essentially if you're the rejected party on a side of this kind of a mess, the problem is it's hard to get calibrated. It's hard to get calibrated because sometimes things seem to be good, and then other times they seem to be bad, and when you can't seem to get control of it. And that's pretty frustrating. So the second situation is not miscalibration. It's actually that we're getting real live failure feedback, but it's confusing, and we can't figure out the pattern of success. Now, this could be with a lot of things. Could be with a career. Could be with a relationship with your parents. Could be relationship with a romance. Could be romantic partners in general. All could be many things. So what we're going to try to do in the next few minutes is sort of talk about some general principles at how to succeed at life improvement. There's a fundamental process that we want to get to. There's a fundamental process that we're going to use. And it's a process called a position of power. And a position of power takes place that with whatever it is that you want, this mate, this job, this career, this success, this friendship circle, this house, this car, et cetera, this body, whatever it is that you're seeking, those things have competitive constraints on them. And you may or may not have what it takes to obtain those things, okay? Those things are not under your direct control. They are, you have indirect influence over whether or not you can obtain that mate, obtain that feedback, obtain that job, obtain that doctorate, obtain that level of success, obtain that house, etc. You do not have direct control. In fact, it is not under your control. It is only under your indirect influence relative to your efforts. So therefore, you are not in a position of power with respect to whether or not you have those things. So what we want to do is we want to get to a position of power, and a position of power is a psychological place that is basically inner peace that comes with realizing that if we don't get there, that we're going to survive. This is it's very useful to consider with respect to mates, job, financial success or anything else under the sun, that the following is true. Number one, there is essentially an infinite possibility of an infinite number of mates. You've got a lot of time. You could find a new one. There is no one mate that settles the issue. Okay? There's no one job that settles the issue. There's no one house that settles the issue, etc. Okay? Human beings have been happy and very happy without any fancy houses and without any fancy cars, without any fancy titles and without any fancy glorious anything, without any number one New York Times bestsellers, etc. The human beings have been happy when they have earned esteem in the right way from the people that matter to them. That will create human happiness. So our job is to take aim at that process. And the most important person that we're going to earn esteem from is going to be from the individual themselves. So the most important component when it comes to any clinical problem that walks through my door, no matter what the person is frustrated about, no matter what competitive situation has them stymied, frustrated, depressed, miserable, anxious, jealous, doesn't matter what it is. Okay? We go through a series of steps where we walk our way through psychologically some very important truths. And the important truths are that no one person, no one goal, no one situation is the deciding factor of our happiness. If that were true, that would indeed be cruel. Okay? It turns out that that's not true, because your happiness is dependent upon whether or not you earn esteem in the right way from the people that matter. And you can do that. That is always possible. That is always within your possibility. If you do very good things and you do them in a very good way and you don't get esteem from some people, then they're not the right people. Okay. So, the most important person that we're going to earn esteem from is the person themselves. So this now ties into how it is that we set goals. So when we set goals for self-improvement in any dimension, the reason why we're setting those goals for self-improvement is because we're attempting to become more competitive in some very important competitive arena of life. It's usually has to do with our competitiveness in the marketplace with respect to either finances, with respect to mates, or with respect to friends. That's generally it's generally some process like that. So it's going to turn out that whatever those things are, whatever the competitive niche it is that we are trying to deal with, that there are obvious sub-goals that are involved in becoming more competitive. If you're an actress, there's things that you can do to become a better actress. If you're trying to be a soccer player, there's things that you can do to become a better soccer player. If you're trying to be a salesperson, there's things that you could do to become a better salesperson. If you're trying to be a surgeon, there's things that you could do to increase your likelihood of becoming a surgeon. In other words, there's always something that you can do, and those things are usually not very complicated. But they might be just complicated enough that you're not very good at them, and they're what I call the fundamentals or the rudiments. And so we can break down any competitive problem to rudiments. We always can. And we look at those rudiments, and our job, usually we can look out at the marketplace and see what other people are doing better than the individual is doing. Maybe they're thinner. Maybe they're more muscular. Maybe they're wealthier. Maybe they have better hair. Maybe they have better clothes, better car, better country club. Who knows what it is that they have better. And maybe it's making an influence on the marketplace, and maybe it isn't. But the point is that our job is to break down whatever the competitive problem is and address our competitive deficits. Okay? Now, we might look at the competitive deficits and say, you know what, I don't want to do it. I'm good enough. At which point, it's very useful to draw a line between the competitive deficit and the negative feedback that we're getting from the marketplace. And we can say, we believe that there's a reason why the marketplace is giving you feedback that is not as good as you want. And it's because we have a competitive deficit over here. Okay. And the person says, yes, but I don't want to address the competitive deficit. No problem. It's cost-benefit analysis. All right. sometimes the person doesn't want to address the competitive deficit because they don't think that they can actually do it, that they can't improve that much. Our job is to fearlessly address competitive deficits by attempting to address the fundamental components of the competitive deficit and put the time and energy and effort in order to improve this. And if it turns out that it does not address the competitive deficit sufficiently to improve our market enough that we're all excited about it, then so be it. But what does happen when we do this is the following, is that the self-esteem mechanism notices our diligent effort. The self-esteem mechanism cannot help itself. It is a ruthless and pitiless judge. It watches us and it watches our degree of effort, and it gives our feedback about our competitive effort. Nathaniel Brandon, who is a Los Angeles psychologist, he was a member of the so-called objectivist movement in the 1960s. He was a protege of the philosopher novelist Ayn Rand. And he went on and broke away from that and became a sort of major theorist and thinker in the concepts of self-esteem. He never did tie self-esteem into evolutionary process. He didn't understand that. He died before that became sort of mainstream thinking in elite academic psychology. But he had many fine insights about self-esteem, as with some mistakes, but some many, many fine insights. And what he said, or one of his quotes, is that self-esteem is the reputation that you have with yourself. And this is exactly accurate. This is precisely right. That a lot of human unpleasantness or negative feelings and depression, of course, what we see on the surface is the person's frustration and feelings of defeat or anger with the market feedback. They're upset at being rejected. They feel like it's unfair, or they feel defeated and it feels hopeless. Whatever it is that the situation is, the only reason they're experiencing a negative reaction is because their expectations are violated in the negative, and they are at a loss because they don't understand really the dynamics. Or if they think they understand the dynamics, they feel powerless to change them. Our job as individuals, or certainly as a therapist, but even as an individual addressing your own life, your job is to look at this as fearlessly as possible. And maybe you need help and maybe you don't. Maybe all you need is the clarity to say, listen, what is my competitive deficit? What would it take? How much effort would it take to improve the competitive feedback? The truth is, there's almost always something that you can do to improve your competitive position in almost any domain. And so what we're talking about here is neurons firing and muscles contracting. We're talking about hustle. And it's going to turn out that if we start to put out hustle and we start to also use our brains and learn and ask questions and get expert feedback and opinion and learn and grow and make more efforts and fail and then try to study the failure, what will happen is that our ability to succeed in this domain will evolve. And it's certainly not going to evolve down. It can only evolve up as we get more competence. And so what will happen along the way as we fight for every bit of increased competence at these rudiments or fundamentals is our self-esteem mechanism will be observing us, and it will be nodding its head and knowing that we are trying and giving good effort. Now, the biggest secret in psychology, not known to psychologists, there are many secrets that they don't know, but the biggest one that people don't know is they don't know just how fast the self-esteem mechanism can change. This is what people don't know. So let me just fire a few examples. This could be a person that's out of shape. This is a guy that's kind of overweight and he's not very strong and he doesn't feel very good about himself and he doesn't feel very competitive and he doesn't get feedback from the women that he would really want to get feedback from. He's a 5, but he's genetically a 7, and he doesn't he's not so arrogant that he thinks he could get a 10, but he's kind of hoping and he's holding out for an 8. And he's 35 years old and he's 40 pounds overweight, and he does a little drinking and he smokes a little pot, and he isn't doing that well financially, and he's frustrated and lonely. Okay, this guy has all kinds of options, all kinds of options. There is nothing, there is no human being standing between him and becoming fabulously in condition. There is no human standing in the way. Okay, there's no human standing in the way from him getting extra jobs on the weekends and finding out how to get his life financially better so that he's in better shape financially. There's nothing standing in the way from him eating much, much healthier food and getting his skin cleared up. There's nothing stopping him from getting a better haircut than the haircut that he's got. There's nothing to stop him from earning some of that extra money and getting better clothes than the one that he's got and a better car than the one that he's got. So literally, this guy, if he would actually contract some muscles, get to sleep on time, shut the internet off at 10 o'clock, get up in the morning and exercise, et cetera, literally, this guy could turn his life completely around. And there's nobody stopping him. Okay? Now, the reason why I feel passionately about this is that people, I'm not berating people like a Methodist minister. I want people are asleep at the switch very often. They're suffering quietly. They're suffering indefinitely. And they do not understand and grasp just how much control they have. What this guy looks at is he thinks, wow, that would be a lot of effort. I'm not even sure it would pay off. You know, I'm not even sure that if I ever found somebody that, you know, if I turn my life around in 8 months from now, everything would look great, I might find somebody, but I would feel like a fraud. It's like all this is going through his head. Then she finds out from my friends that I used to be 40 pounds heavier. Then she dumps me, et cetera, et cetera. Who knows what goes through this head? But here's what goes through my head. What he doesn't know is that in 3 weeks, his self-esteem mechanism will be excited. He doesn't know that he's 3 weeks away. If he does an excellent job, his self-esteem mechanism will be nodding at him like a very tough, very honest, straight alpha football coach that's basically saying, good job, good job. I can see you're working hard. You may be the weakest guy on our team, but I'm watching you hop those bleachers in the sun, and I'm seeing you work really hard, and that's all right. That's all right, Oglethorpe. You're doing all right. Okay? That's exactly what that internal coach is going to be saying if you work hard. And that feeling, self-esteem feeling, is drowned out or can be seemingly drowned out by how acute the feedback is when the esteem mechanism gets feedback from other people. The direct feedback from other people is very acute and very impactful. The self-esteem mechanism is very slow and very methodical. Okay? The esteem mechanism, a reaction to other people, is like the stock market going up and down every day and everybody's either excited or devastated as it moves. The self-esteem mechanism is like the quarterly average of how this thing moves. If you put 3 weeks in on this thing, you put the first dot on the graph. And the self-esteem mechanism looks behind at the last 3 weeks and says, you're doing a pretty good job. Okay? So this is how it is that we attack human life and its problems. The problems are always, I'm not going to say always, sometimes there's very complicated or tragic circumstances that are odd and idiosyncratic. But I will say that 95%+ of the problems that ever come to me as a psychologist come of this pattern. Okay, the person is experiencing some negative feedback. They're frustrated and they can't figure out what to do. They need coaching as to the rudiments, and then they need to apply themselves to those rudiments and improve their abilities in those areas, and their feelings about themselves will generally improve much more rapidly than the feedback will from the outside world. Okay, we get addicted to the process of defending and enhancing the reputation that we have with ourselves. That's the lesson that echoes through Nathaniel Brandon's work, And it forms the core of what it is that I try to do with what I call Esteem Dynamics.
Fantastic. And for anybody listening, if you do feel like you have a problem that is outside the scope of just what you've heard, feel free to call into the show and have a session with Dr. Lyle on air with, talking about a problem. He can walk you through it. Or your website, right? It's esteemdynamics.org, and they can talk to you one-on-one.
Very good.
Dr. Lyle, thank you very much.
My pleasure, and we'll talk to you next week.
Sounds good. Talk to you next week.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.